Okay, yes, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to another brand new Rugby Muscle podcast. I'm your host, as always, TJ, and today I'm honoured to be joined by another rugby strength coach, and this is Joel Harris of Strength Solution. Joel is as strong as an ox, and rather than get into his whole bio, I think I'll let him introduce himself, so I will do once I get him on the call. For now, though, I would like to just say, if you enjoy these specific interview episodes, they are a little bit more arduous, I say, not a lot more, but they're a little bit more arduous to set up than the solo episodes. I really do enjoy them, and if you really enjoy them, let me know by giving this one a thumbs up on YouTube and letting us know on the reviews on Spotify in the comments section, or just by giving us a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcast. We'll be getting a number of fellow rugby strength coaches, and it'll be interesting to see where we agree, where we disagree, and where we can find common ground. And for you guys as the listeners, as rugby players, I think you're going to get a lot from it. So without further ado, let's get into this one with Joel Harris. So tell me, like, essentially your background. I know your background was as a rugby player yourself. You said recently that you've now retired, or not recently, you just told me 2 seconds ago that you retired. But I want to know, like, your background, how you got into being like a specific rugby strength coach. And then we can just sort of riff from there.
Yeah, yeah, sounds good, mate. And first of all, thanks for having me on. It's always nice to come and chat about this shit. My missus doesn't have to listen to me then. But
she still will.
Yeah, sure. This will be on in the car, let me tell you. But yeah, it's one of those ones. I've played rugby pretty much growing up all my life, and it was something that was such a big part of who I was. But I wasn't the most genetically gifted of individuals. I was 5 foot fat growing up in the valleys, and you know, the only sport that I really lent into was playing rugby. And it got to a point where, you know, you're going through the motions, but I was lucky enough then with my own throwing myself into training and seeing what happens. I had the luxury of playing, you know, the Wales under 20s level, stepped up into some of the academies and actually saw what goes on at the highest level. And I think for me, it made me realize the stark contrast of what actually goes on at the professional game versus the grassroots game. And I think that's what's intriguing to actually leaning in towards helping rugby players and really specializing in that aspect. Not only have I been there, done that, and kind of quote-unquote worn the t-shirt myself, I knew the disparity between what was going on at the grassroots, where they're just sinking pints and smashing pies 24/7, versus what goes on at the elite level. And I felt like there was a real gap that needed to be filled, and it was being filled with pointless bodybuilding stuff, powerlifting things, and they were the things that I kind of grew up on and started to implement into my own training. And they were the mistakes that I made that I want to kind of help others not make throughout their own journey, because it's a common thing, and I can imagine you see it quite a lot with people going through. So yeah, that was like a little whistle stop tour of me and your background.
Mate, that's interesting. So like, got a few questions from that. Firstly, give me a bit more of a time scale of this. So you said that you weren't overly genetically blessed. So when did you start playing rugby? Because at some point you must have realized, actually, no, I'm all right, if you ended up making, well, Wales under 20s.
Yeah. So with that, timeline wise, I think I got pushed into rugby at the age of, I think it was 12. I always wanted to play football, but like I said, I had 2 left feet as well. So it was a case of off the cards. And there was a rugby team that I almost got forced into. It was something that I was always quite hesitant, being, you know, not genetically gifted. I was like, you know what, I don't want to go play a sport where people are going to try and run and take my head off. So I got forced up there and coerced.
Did your dad play?
So it wasn't my dad, it was my grandfather. My grandfather was always dubbed to be, from people that I spoke to, one of the best Welsh players to never get a Welsh cap. They call him the Gentle Giant. He was 6'6", and he played second row, played with like the old Ebervale, RTBs, and when they combined, nice. They were like scoring squad, and they played against the All Blacks, played against Australia, South Africa. So he had quite a good resume, but he never got the Welsh cap. And it was only when I started playing and got kind of hooked on it that I was really interested into learning his story and his upbringing. And I think that's what triggered it for me. I think that's what triggered the fact that when I started playing, I realized, even though I wasn't the best athlete, I was always bigger than everyone. And I think that gave me the vote of confidence that I needed to start off with. And then from there, it kind of evolved. I think 14 was when I found the gym and realized that, you know what, I actually do need to start taking this serious if I did want to step up as the as a good player and hopefully get that Welsh cap. Because, yeah, it was something that whenever my grandmother told stories about my grand, that was the first thing that would always come up would be the mantelpiece photos and the touring photos that he had, and was like, yeah, that he always deserved that Welsh cap, so you can go do it as well. And I think that was a massive part in why I took to rugby as well.
I can imagine, because that's like, because I always think about this, like, it's not for glory of anyone else. It's just the fact that you get to, like, tell these stories. And that's all you're, I think that's all any of it is. Like, no matter what high level you play or professionally you do or whatever, it's all about, like, your own experience and then how you would feel retelling that story to other people. So, like, yeah, I totally used my career to do that as well. So it's, I never really thought about, like, oh, could I earn a living doing this, or can I, you know, reach the highest level for glory? Because especially, I mean, it's probably different in Wales, but like in England, or especially in the US, where I played the last of my rugby, you walk like, or you go through to, like, you could take Sia Khaleesi and walk him through like the busiest mall. No one's going to know who he is. And like Owen Farrell can just walk through the street, and again, he'll get a few like people going, oh, who's like, I recognize him, but you won't get him stopped. Football players, like, they can't do that. So it's like, no one really does care, even if you play at the absolute highest level that you can with rugby. So it's just about what story you can tell. And I think, like, that's something that you say there's a big disparity to, like, from professionals to amateurs. I think that's one where amateurs sort of sell themselves short, because it's all about how much fun you can have and the stories that you can tell. And I think, like, that's, if amateurs can experience that as well by playing their better rugby, then that's only going to enhance their own, like, life, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I think the stories that people try and tell themselves at the amateur level and the lower level games is the tour stories, the drinking, all and that. But one of like the most influential coaches on me, he always said, you have more fun when you win in anyway. So like the beers that you taste after the game, the celebrations that you have, the songs that you sing all mean that little bit more when you are winning. And I think people can kind of cut themselves short, like you said, on the fact that, oh, you know what, I only play it for the social side of things. So I'm like, yeah, socially, you'll have a much better time if you're beating teams week in, week out, and you're actually happy with 100%. Your own performances. And people
If you're out on the booze and you've lost, you still can have a great time. But every few minutes or every half hour or a couple times an hour, you're just like, ah, oh, fuck, if we'd have just won. You know what I mean? Like, the amount of times I've done like sevens tournaments as well, where it would have been great, and then we like lost in the final. You're like, oh, that's a great memory. But fuck, we lost. You know, like,
yeah, it'll always taint that memory as well. And that's the thing. Whenever you kind of go back to the big moments that you've had within your rugby career, I can imagine it's probably off the back of big wins, you know, where you were the underdog or you came from behind, you put in a stellar performance, and they're the ones that you can remember, and they're the beers that you can remember after as well. So it's weird that people just turn up to rugby on a Saturday. They can't be asked for training on a Tuesday, Thursday. They just wing it. They pick up injuries all the time. They're really unfit. They're 20 minutes around the park and they're blowing out their ass, and they're like, oh yeah, I love rugby. And I'm like, you just love getting pissed, mate. You can do that without the Saturday.
You can love it so much more. It's so true. You just want these mates to get drunk with. But if you actually got in shape, you would enjoy it so much more. So let's talk about you getting into shape. So you said you hit the gym 14. That's like, that's a decent age to start taking it somewhat seriously. What did that look like?
So it probably the typical person getting into training. I had my heart broken at the age of 14, and I was like, no, you know what, I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna change it. So the people that you see online at the time, I think social media wasn't as big as what it is now in terms of the availability of great information. So I just started learning from the typical men's health magazines. You know, you'd see Arnold on the cover, there'd be big social media influencers that were kind of Steve Cook, all those people. And I just kind of took a liking to that because they were the people that were in good shape at the time. And I thought that's what I needed to be, because you look at athletes, they look a certain way. And I thought, well, if I chase that, the performance on the pitch will come. And it just meant that I was turning up to the gym, the typical pro split. You know, Arnold, I think it's Arnold's 8-week blueprint was the program that I decided to run. And it's a common thing.
The Muscle Farm one.
Yes, that was exactly it.
Yeah.
It's iconic, mate, iconic. But I didn't have a clue. I just turned up to the gym and I just follow that to a T. And, you know, it got me making progress, which was the biggest thing. But I think only when you look back with the knowledge that you got now do you realize the kind of holes and the flaws in it. But the big thing, it was getting me to the gym 3 times a week alongside training. I brought one of my mates alongside, and I think I realized the importance of having someone on the journey with you as well. So the two of us would just turn up and that would be our days. And I think the first transformation was the biggest for me. I think I ended up losing 30 kilo. And that was the catalyst where I thought, oh, you know what, performance is increasing. And yeah, for me, that was the early days of it. But yeah, it was some of the shit thrown into that.
Some of those early days, it's like you just grasp whatever you can, because I think the whole thing is kind of overwhelming. And the reality is when you're just beginning, like everything works. And if you can stick with it long enough, the biggest thing I think you take away is that just that lesson that if you stick with something long enough and you see that progress, like that's one of the most reaffirming things that you can actually get. And it's why you see so many people that are into fitness, like sort of expand into like other business domains or whatever. Like, you know, you look at someone like The Rock, and that's like, not saying that most people that go to the gym are going to end up like him, but he's like the perfect example of, right, I've done this, or Arnold himself. You know, I've done this, I've achieved this, I've set my goals and done whatever. I've progressed to getting in like achieving in this area. Now I'm going to progress to achieving in that area, or I'm going to progress in this way. And if you can just like know that just putting in your efforts and that delayed gratification, like it can be huge. And again, being a beginner, no matter what, like you know, when you look at the science, people that just start running actually gain muscle on their legs. So it's like, you can do anything and you're going to gain muscle, and that's cool. You know, mine was the 300 workout from the Jim Jones stuff. That was like, it was like early days CrossFit before it was CrossFit, and probably a little bit more extreme, but I don't know. It looked cool. And, I felt cool whilst doing it. And yeah, it's just that ability to sort of see it in your physique as well. See how your body changes and then like actually feel good about it. And then know that, okay, if I can put this action into a certain direction, I can get this output.
No, and I think that's a great point there. It's like, it looked cool at the point as well. And I think, you know, at that age, when you're just kind of getting into it, you worry about splitting hairs, about all this other stuff. But like you said, just running is the catalyst for gaining muscle for people that are complete beginners. So if you could just do something, whether you enjoy it, whether it looks cool, whether, you know, you, whatever it is, as long as there's something that you can vibe with. And I think for me, that was one of the easy things. There was not a lot of overwhelm there like there is now, because you go on social media and, you know, it's part of our job is to put the right information out there, but every single man and their dog has an opinion on absolutely everything nowadays. And it can leave people a little bit like, well, where do I actually turn? Because you look at one thing, it says something, you look at something else, it says something else. But essentially, yeah, if you can just find a avenue that you enjoy, that you like the look of, and you can stick with it, that lesson of delayed gratification will come at some point, whether it's 3 months, 6 months, 9 months down the line, if you keep doing up, like doing the thing and showing up, you're going to get the results at some point when you're in that kind of early days.
Yeah. So social media just tends to be, the algorithms always respond a little bit better to like negative stuff, because we just, as I don't know, as humans, like sort of, I guess, feel a need to comment more often. That's why like you get Joel Seedman's stuff get so popular, because people love to bash it and it just feeds the algorithm for the bloke. And all he just has to do is put up. And I remember he did an interview with Kier or a debate with Kier, and he was like, 90% of the stuff I do isn't posted on Instagram. I was like, yeah, so you know exactly what you're fucking doing, because that's the stuff that gets the results. But the quirky shit goes on Instagram. People hate it. People need to tell everyone, okay, this doesn't work. And then we end up, and the problem with social media is that we then end up telling everyone, and I'm guilty of this on my own social media, I'm saying like, don't do this because this doesn't work. because that's going to get more traction. But then eventually there's going to be people say, don't do what I preach. Like people say, I know other rugby strength coaches will say, oh, you shouldn't do long, slow runs. When I think the opposite. I think long, slow runs can be massively beneficial for rugby players. Now, I'm sure that they don't produce people just as fit as what I can produce, and that's fine. And again, what we're probably doing is splitting hairs. But for the untrained eye or for the inexperienced eye, you're like, oh, am I supposed to run? Am I not supposed to run? Okay, I'm supposed to do this. I'm supposed to do this. What the fuck do I do? And it ends up, yeah, overwhelming is the word that you said. I think that's a big problem with it, right?
Yeah, 100%. And like you said, I think all roads lead to Rome, and every single person just has their own way of getting there. And I could imagine we could end up arguing about something in your system versus my system that you disagree with or I agree with, but then we'd have so many different common grounds that we agree on. And I think the problem is, like you said, that negative social media algorithm. There's a social media guy from where I'm from, and his whole Instagram is just calling out people that are wrong. And he's like, the only reason why I call people out all the time is because it builds that traction and it builds that algorithm, and people start commenting. One of my best posts had over 500,000 views, and it was people arguing in the comment section for me. And that's the only thing that fueled it. And nice. I went to the gym yesterday, and he was like, someone was like, oh, I saw the comments on that video. How'd you put up with it? And I'm just like, well, at the end of the day, it feeds my page, and whether some people think it's right or wrong, if they want to argue with me, I'll quite happily argue till the cows come home. But it's one of those ones where, yeah, at the end of the day, it's a sad reality of Instagram and how people work nowadays. But yeah, you've got to do what you've got to do.
Yeah, I know. It's because it is interesting to see, because I've only started, like, I took basically a couple of years off of Instagram. If you scroll far enough down my feed on Rugby Muscle, you'll just see all of a sudden it, like, jumps like a couple of years, or there's like a few spare posts within those years. Because all I did was this YouTube and the podcast stuff. But the reality is that Instagram is where most people are. There's just still the volume of eyes on that is still different. I like these podcasts because they're just more searchable. So I think for me, especially with the Reels now, I debate how much. I think the idea of Instagram is great to get some information, to get to know someone, but then the work, you're not. I don't know many people, and maybe we can disagree on this. I don't know many people that would follow someone on Instagram and get enough tangible information that they could actually implement that would really get them massively different results than if they just didn't see that person, if that makes sense.
No, 100%. I think that's the landscape of me for Instagram is, it's like one of the fastest growing platforms apart from TikTok in terms of like eyes on people. And yeah, like you said, how much information can you get across in a 30 to 60 second reel? Probably not a lot. If you're going one point, there's some people that I follow that, you know, repeatedly hit home certain points that I vibe with, and then I've dabbled in longer form content, and it is that top of funnel stuff, the whole funnel, all this, where, you know, social media and Instagram is right there, and like YouTube podcast stuff is where ultimately I think people need to start to get to. But I think you get found out when you set on a podcast for 45 hour, however long it is, or do a longer YouTube video, and it's not clickbaity, and it is the harder platform to grow, I can imagine, based on you know, the numbers and stuff that you've done and the time that it's taken to build that. It's,
yeah,
you know, probably one of the most rewarding ones though in the long run.
I just always try and value putting out the best information, and I just don't, I think it's also creatively, I just don't like the short form content as much. It's just, it's hard for me. Probably because I tend to ramble, but I want to make sure that everything is perfectly covered off, but maybe I'm just not good at it. I don't know. I think you make a good point though, like in the more experienced people do end up getting found out. Like I like this as well, because sometimes I'll flush my own ideas out, and then even then I'll go back and I'll be like, maybe I was wrong with that. And where with Instagram, that's gone. People have completely forgotten about that. You can always just repost from like 6 months ago, and no one remembers it as a repost. Everyone just thinks it's new. So let's see if we can find you out, mate. So I want to know what sort of shaped your own influences on being a rugby strength coach? Like, I know the disparity between amateurs. Well, actually, let's touch on that first. So what were the biggest disparities between amateurs and professionals that you thought, okay, this is where I can fill this gap?
So I think when it comes to the differences between the top level and I'd say the amateur, I think it's the standards that most people hold themselves to. I think the biggest thing that I realized was, like, whenever it came to, you know, gym sessions, it would be a case of if you're late, you know, you've got a fine to do. Or, you know, if you weren't on time, you couldn't miss a day. It was more like a contractual thing. You had to be at the gym. And that's all well and good for someone that's kind of being paid to be there and work. But I think even when people strip things back to fit their schedule from an amateur level, they let the standards slip. They let the barriers, like, the barrier to high performance, they kind of drop that slightly. So when you were being held accountable in a performance setting, you'd have people with a program there. You'd have people tracking your numbers. You make sure that you'd want to beat it. You wouldn't want to be late. You wouldn't want to miss a session, all those things. So I think they're the big foundational rocks that, like, build that consistency and they build that long-term habit. And I think that's just purely missing from most people just from the get-go, regardless of whether they're doing the wrong program or anything. They just don't have that bare bone structure and they don't actually understand what goes into actually performing at a higher standard, because mm-hmm. the way that Instagram's gone is always kind of quick fixes, things like that, and they think that's the route to it. So I think the first thing is just the understanding of what actually goes in from a mindset standpoint. And I think once you can start to get at different individuals, whatever program they're running, I think that's why so many coaches doing different things out there, is if you can get that buy-in early on and start to actually track the data for people, get them being accountable, turn it up on time, actually doing the right things, then from the basic habits, they're going to start to make progress regardless of whether they're going in the like right or wrong direction in terms of the rugby stuff. But then once they do get that structure in place, most amateur people, they just follow the kind of powerlifting, bodybuilding, the general 5x5, 3x12, whatever it may be. You know, they've seen someone do drop sets, they'll implement that. And that's as far as their S&C goes. And I think unanimously across country to wherever, bodybuilding dominates the kind of fitness space at the minute. So I think that's where everyone pulls their information from. And I think it's a part of training S&C for rugby is getting a good muscle base in place. But if that's where you stop, I think you've shot yourself in the foot. And I think that's what I realized was the difference maker, was that it goes beyond hypertrophy, it goes beyond strength. And there's this kind of like whole, we call it the core four, that takes to being a good rugby player: strength, speed, power, conditioning. Like they're the kind of main fundamental aspects, and only one of those tends to really get ticked off by most amateur rugby players.
Yeah, massive. The accountability is probably huge as well. I think it's like I've spoken to a few people about this recently because we were talking about like motivations and whatnot, and it's like, if you're a professional and you stop going to the gym as much, even if you're like, well, firstly, if you're not going to your team sessions, like that puts you all the way down. You stop performing. You like your coaches can see that and know why. Even if you're like having your own individual sessions, your performance is going to inevitably slowly go down. And there's so many people that are in that space that are so hungry for that, especially now all the youngsters that have been starting since a young age, bodies are primed, hungry for that contract. There's less and less money in outside of France. There's less money for more playing positions than probably ever. And so like, if you don't do it, you like what sort of accountability is your job? Like, it's a massive, like people don't not show up to their job because they're hungover or because they don't feel like it. They do their job no matter what. They always show up. And that's what the gym is for a professional. For an amateur, it's not. For an amateur, unless you're nicely, if you've got everything organized, it's much easier. If you don't, it's much harder. It's so much harder because that's the first thing to go. You're not, again, you're going to show up to work no matter what. So that's already, I don't know, what do normal people work? 8 hours, 9 hours a day? Like, that's already off your schedule. Sleep. You can't just not sleep, especially, well, you're not going to set, people do sacrifice gym for the or sleep for the gym. I don't think that's a winning battle either. So you end up and like being somewhat inconsistent because it's not there. You have to make it a priority as part of your schedule. And again, because it's part of your job as a professional, you're going to do it. If it's not, you have to treat it the same way, right?
No, and that, like I always remember driving to training, and you'd be stuck on the M4, you'd be driving somewhere, and you'd be stuck in traffic. And the anxiety about being late, you'd like have to text across being like, I'm running late, I'm stuck in traffic. You'd have to show proof that, you know, you're there. And people, like, that's been driven into me now, and that's the standard that I hold myself by. It's like, well, I want to make sure that I'm on time for things. I want to make sure that I don't actually second guess and just kind of let the excuses, because I think it is a negative cycle loop either way. So you carry on doing the right thing. It's a positive loop where you're reinforcing that good decision. You show up, you get the results, and it breeds more of that. But when you let the excuses win, it's a case of you skip one gym session, what's the next? So you're running late for this, you half-ass this, and then it's that negative feedback loop the other way. So I think you've got to be really, really strict on that kind of accountability, those boundaries, and actually setting yourself that structure. Because I think as soon as that starts to go, it's like you said, it becomes a losing battle for most people.
Yeah, absolutely. And then once you do get that motivation, or you get that, I don't like using motivation. You just get consistency, right? Now, whether you're disciplined because you enjoy it, which then are you really disciplined or are you motivated? Whatever. You show up to the gym consistently. Again, it's still, we're doing our best as we can, but you're right. Like, because, especially, I think it's even worse with social media, because fitness, you can't see fitness, right? You can get phenomenal runners that look like nothing. You can get phenomenal athletes, rugby players even, that don't look like, you put them in a normal, in a hoodie, and no one will notice that they're even a rugby player outside of like Eben Etzebeth and people like that. So then it's like, what does performance look like? We don't know. So then social media leans into, okay, it looks like this, shredded physique, massive bulging pecs, popping quads, or just someone really lean, whatever, like, and it becomes a visual thing. And really, for most people that aren't athletes, that are just looking to get in shape, 90% of the reason they want to do it, you even said, because your missus broke up with you, right? I'm going to show her, I'm going to look better. Yeah, there's like, and me, I watched the movie 300. Oh, those guys are ripped. That's cool. I want to look like that, right? So it's the same thing. We're so visual. So then that's what gets traction. So then that's the training that we end up looking for. And it's funny, you said, your core four, strength, speed, conditioning, and power, right?
Yes.
Hypertrophy is a part of a couple of those things, maybe, but it's not actually a goal. It's a byproduct of training for other things. Even then, when you understand that, okay, you then follow, I don't care about how I look. I just want to get really strong. Who are the strongest people? Oh, I've got to follow these power lifters. Oh, that means I've got to squat, bench, and deadlift. But that's just because of the rules of powerlifting. But that's just how you do it. And the third stop in that road is usually end up being like some sort of CrossFit, because actually I don't want to just get strong. I want to get strong and fit. What do I got to do? I got to do CrossFit. And again, it's a different sport with its own specific like conditions that you've got to get good at. And so with CrossFit, it's different, like certain wads and certain aspects which use different energy systems than what rugby does. So again, it's about, and I think people listen to this podcast now know there's a big difference with that, yet still there ends up being a little bit of a discrepancy in the way that they train, because it's just simple. Again, we've done it's hard because we've also, I don't know what that camera's doing now, come back down here. It's hard because we also want things to be simple. Right, we don't want to overcomplicate stuff. It's because of fitness ended up being overwhelming, but at the same time, simple doesn't mean training like a powerlifter or like a bodybuilder or like someone that has different goals to you, because it's not going to get you to your goals.
Yeah, and I think that the problem is that the landscape of social media is always people want the hardest result in the easiest way possible and the least hassle. And the thing is, getting in shape, being a great rugby player isn't easy.
No.
But it's not complicated. That's the problem. People, I think, mix up the terms easy and hard and simple and complicated. Like, it's not easy to get in, like, the best shape for rugby. But it's quite simple. It's just hard. And when people see that word hard, they're like, they immediately bounce into complex, fancy things because they feel like that constitutes hard, but it's just mentally stimulating rather than actually making you better. And like you said, you bounce from that, you go into bodybuilding, you try the powerlifting route, you try the CrossFit route, and then you end up at a point, well, these are the people in best shape, these are the strongest people, these are the fittest people, how come I'm neither of these? And it's like, well, that's where then people start to, it must be this, it must be this, it must be that, it must be that one thing that I'm not doing. And the problem is, when you're kind of putting out social media content, that's the hooks and the things that actually get people listening to your content, is that one thing that you're not doing. And then people are like, well, what is it? And it's the landscape of social media. But like you said, it's not complicated. It's actually quite straightforward and quite simple when you break it down into its simplest parts. But is that because you know a lot more than most?
And it's also like, the complication is more on the back end, right? Is like assessing what you need to work on. Oh, okay. Like you can say, I just lift because it's simple. But if you're really unfit, okay, like that, there's a level of complication to establish that, and then to say, okay, it doesn't need to be complicated. Go do some basic aerobic work or whatever, or the opposite end of the spectrum where you've got someone that's really fit but really weak, but they say, I just run and do like my basic bodyweight workouts because I want to keep it simple. But again, if you're weak, you've got to address that issue. I think you're so right, though, where because it is difficult and because like we bias, again, on social media as well, right? Who gets the most traction? It's the people with the best results, the really strong people, the freakishly big people or powerful people or whatever. Like the worst one, and we're all, I think you might be the only one if you're not guilty of this. Every rugby page will repost Joshua Tuasova because the man is the most jacked person ever. I don't think he even lifts weights. Like, he's just a freak. So you can't follow his advice, yet you could lift weights perfectly for years on end and do everything right and not look a fraction of this guy. And that doesn't mean that you haven't done everything right. It doesn't mean that you've missed the one trick, but human nature is to look for those tricks. And yeah, you're right. You can give like the perfectly most well-balanced reel and put that out there, or do the best video and like really be perfectly balanced with you and give the best advice. People ain't going to click it because they want to know the secret still. And you have to sort of shoehorn the basics in via different levels of entertainment or hooks that, again, keep them interested.
And it's the nature of the beast, quite sadly. But it is one of those ones that you look back and, like, every rugby page does it. I've posted the mammoth that he is on my page as well. I was like, it's genetics kind of does play a big factor into some of this, and they are built differently over that side of the world as well.
It's the other complication, I think, and I think this is one of our first posts that we got chatted on, is training splits. Because people love to talk about training splits because they always ask, what's the best split for a flanker? I'm like, mate, I don't know. Like, that's not a question. That's not really like, and I guess that is because people look for, again, it's looking for that perfect solution. Oh, if I just get the perfect split, then I'm going to be able to like make massive gains in my squat, but also get really fit and faster and do all of these different things. Whereas actually, I think, again, it's a more complicated analysis that's required to come up with the best training split for you. I want to know, I guess we can sort of touch on that then. What would be, you've posted a few different splits, so how would you look at managing the different of your core four? Right, mine I have five pillars, so I add movement and I call it athleticism. It's just different movement capacities in there, so I add that as a fifth, but that can easily be worked into the other four, however you would define it. So your four, how do you go about working those four different elements at the same time, or do you even work them at the same time?
So I think this is where, are they going to be better and worse splits for rugby? Yes, 100%. Like there are going to be ways that I feel that, you know, if you consider like consolidating stresses, and that's why I think hybrid has become so so popular at the minute. Like you said, it's a case of people want that new fancy thing, and hybrid is that thing where it's like combining strength and endurance. Now, do the two coexist, and is there something called the interference effect? Yeah, there is, but how important is that for you when you're not an elite level marathon runner trying to go sub 2 hours versus a, you know, world-class powerlifter that's trying to break the heaviest total ever? If you lie on that spectrum, probably it's not so much. So whenever it comes to kind of designing that, we'll add your fifth pillar in there, because I really like the movement slash athleticism thing, because that underpins everything, I think. Mm-hmm. So you've always got to kind of take into consideration the athlete that's coming in, and you've got to look at what they can do. Now, whenever we're in the gym, there's a skill element and there's a skill component to the weights that we do. So, for example, a back squat is a very, very great quad exercise for people to try and build muscle. But if you can't back squat, it's a very shit exercise. Mm-hmm. Whereas a leg extension is very, very good quad exercise and really hard to fuck up as well. Like, if you fuck up a leg extension, you've got to be doing something drastic, like satting it backwards or something. So whenever we're kind of picking a training split, I think the first thing that's got to look is, what are you competently able to do, and where is your kind of baseline level of athleticism? And then that will determine a lot of the movements that go in. Because, like I said, if you are picking a back squat exercise for lower body strength and power, but you can't actually load it, you're not going to be getting that designated stimulus from that movement. You're just going to be working on the skill acquisition of that. So once you've understood what you're actually able to complete, tick off, and actually get the right stimulus, I think it's then about doing a little bit of an evaluation. I think, are you someone, like you said, that runs all the time, does bodyweight workouts, but a week is piss? Or are you someone that trains like a powerlifter, does zero conditioning, and doesn't really focus anything other than squatting below 3 reps, deadlifting below 3 reps, and benching 1 rep max because it looks good? So, like, where do you lie on that spectrum? And I think that's then the baseline foundation of your split. Because there is no perfect split for a flanker. There's no perfect split for rugby. There's no perfect split for getting stronger. There's a perfect split for you and your athlete profile. And then it's just kind of making sure that in season, depending on whether you're someone that needs maybe 2-3 strength stimuluses because you're a little bit weak, you're relatively untrained, and you just need to build that strength base, or whether you're someone that's very, very aerobically poor and you need to be able to last 80 minutes, so you do 2, 3, 4 conditioning pieces, wherever you place those in the training week is ultimately dependent on what allows you to perform on that given Saturday, Sunday, whenever you play. Yeah. And I think strength, you're normally going to take like 72 hours to fully recover, so you probably want that done game day -3. Whereas like anything before that, you're quite competent to be able to say, you know what, come Saturday, I'll recover. When it comes to conditioning stuff, you can do that a little bit later. Maybe Thursday, you can get a good conditioning blast in and actually still feel good for a Saturday. So in a long roundabout way, there is no perfect split. There's no perfect kind of thing that we look at. It's all about assessing the athlete in front of you, understanding their wants, needs, and what they're actually capable of doing, and then building the split and consolidating the stresses around that. For performance on a Saturday. We can dive in a little bit more if you know, there was things that you wanted to cover on that.
Let's do that as well. So we'll touch on in season just a bit. I know a lot of people listening to this are just about to finish their season, I think, so we'll touch on off season strategies as well, but we'll go in season now and we'll say, how do you, and I'll tell you mine after if we're not in complete agreement, but who knows. You say about consolidation of stresses. So how much does rugby training factor into that?
It depends on what the level people play at. And I think rugby training looks very different for a lot of my athletes. Some people turn up to train on a Tuesday and they've got Broncos, they've got hard conditioning sessions, they've got a strength and conditioning coach that loves to challenge the mental toughness aspect of conditioning, regardless of the thoughts on that. And that then plays a massive role in how we're actually going to structure training, because I like to follow kind of like a high-low model. So on high days, you keep your high days high. So if you're kind of training on a Tuesday and you've got those Broncos, you've got high volume running, you've got a big on feet coverage day, well, I wouldn't really place a strength session for lower body on a Wednesday, or I wouldn't probably place it on a Monday. I try and get all those things together on the same day. So it's like, would you rather be shot once or twice? And it's like, well, just shoot me once, get it over with. If it's two bullets, just shoot me once, rather than kind of leave me recover a little bit, go through the surgery, then shoot me again. Like the way that I look at that, that's just kind of along in that period. It's like, get the double barrel straight now, take it, and then you've got that period of time to recover. So we've got some athletes, though, that they turn up train on a Tuesday. They are, I'm going to give a touch. They're on a little bit of a runabout. Maybe they're short on numbers, 8, 9, 10 people turning up. They can't really get into drills, whatever it is. At that point, does it really matter too much? I'll beg to differ. And then it's more about where they can perform in training, because I know that that's going to be the biggest base of adaptation that we're going to look at, and that will be the priority for us then, because, yeah, depending on who and what they do can drastically change.
Actually, if we'd had this discussion a couple of years ago, I probably would have disagreed with you, because I was very adamant with the high-low, like, you know, place all your stresses together, do as best you can to do that. Like, the reality is that training actually for a lot of people, as you said, is really different, and you can actually also challenge some of the athletes to, okay, you're only going to play touch, or you're only going to do whatever drills you're going to do, team run through. I challenge you to keep this as aerobic as possible. So I have some of my guys that wear the whoop straps. I'm like, okay, great. You're going to try and keep it over under 150. And if it goes above 150, your challenge is to get it down as fast as possible after that. So now we're staying aerobic. We're not letting it get too high. So I think then you can manage your stresses a little bit easier. You know, then you're not getting your highs. So you're not really getting shot. You're just getting kind of like stabbed, I guess. Maybe it's not as deep, you know, so you're taking a few more stabs, but none of them are really that deep that are actually going to get you. And you're making that conscious effort. So that's when you can do a bit more, you know, consecutive days of training and have them be all right. I would still like, because I think of the nature of rugby, the nature of like strength work and whatnot, you still do want one real hard stimulus in there, but you can be you've got a little bit more room to play with that. And there's the other area where, look, it's just practicality. If some people cannot go to the gym on their rugby days, does that mean we just never train lower body? Probably not, right? So we have to figure that out.
Yeah, and that's where I think you can kind of get caught in the weeds of like the perfect periodization strategy. But I read a lot of the agile periodization model, which is kind of a way of managing threats. And that's the biggest thing that they look at, is like, what's going to be the biggest detriment here? Is it going to be training a heavy leg session on a Monday before training on a Tuesday? Or is it not getting any heavy strength stimulus regardless throughout the course of the week because of a perfect split? And it's like, well, you know what? I think if you never train lower body strength across the course of a rugby season, you'd have a pretty poor time at trying to manage your performance versus just handling a little bit more stress in 2 days, maybe having two high days back to back and then two low days to recover.
And you can easily just make those high days not quite as high. So instead of maybe doing three sets, maybe it's just one top set and then you get out. Or maybe it's not above 90%. Maybe we just hit 85%. We keep a rep in the tank. You know, so many people would be so surprised at how much or how little volume they really need to continually progress. Not just stay as strong, but actually get stronger. It's nowhere near as much volume or intensity as you're led to believe. And again, that's because who do we like rely on for our strength information? People that only care about strength stuff. They're not like, if they could do five sets or if they could do 100 sets and get stronger, they would do those 100 sets. It's just not an option for most people, particularly if you're doing all these other, if you've got all these other stresses in your week. No, so let's go into off-season real quick. Sorry.
I was just saying that's the beauty of the hybrid trend. I think a lot more people now are starting to tap into the fact that you need a little bit less than what you actually think to actually make progress. So I think it's going to hopefully bleed into the rugby world at some point.
I think it's getting there. I hear more people talking to me that come into like my realm and already know what zone two is and know that like what aerobic effort is. I'm like, oh, brilliant. And then so that makes my job a lot easier. I was going to switch over to off season. So how does that differ to in season as far as, let's say, for what you want to work on and then how you'd go about working on it?
So I think the biggest difference maker for me and the way that I flip it to my athletes when we're off season is it goes from performance to progress. And I think in season is all about how can we maximize performance, not progress. And in the off season is how can we maximize the amount of progress that we're going to make in this period of time. And that is where you have a lot more free rein over athlete schedules. You have a lot more free rein of managing the total stresses, and you have a lot more free rein about how much volume that they can actually do. And depending on the athlete in front of you, a lot of the time it's about building that kind of strength, hypertrophy base, and optimizing body comp throughout that time, just because, you know, if they need to get into a deficit, you don't have to worry about performance on the pitch, like struggling. If they need to get strong because, you know, they've got a 1x bodyweight back squat, but they want to go play back row at a high level, well, you can squat 2-3 times a week if you need to, and there's not going to be any detriment. I think this is where the habit really goes from more of a, I was going to say like a vertical integration approach, where it's like that, trying to juggle everything at once, but you still do that in the off season, but you can make the priority a lot more of a priority. You don't have to spend as much time and effort into, you know, managing the core four that you've got. You can really put a lot of your eggs in one basket and let one tick over very, very, very slowly, as long as it's still there. And that's the difference, and that's the shift.
Yeah, that's massive. And I almost set you up for like poorly with the question, because I get told, you know, or I get asked, in fact, I got asked yesterday, what do I need to work on in the off season? I'm like, mate, fucked if I know. I don't know you. It's hard, you know, because it's just one of those things where your training goals don't change, right? If you're still slow, you're still slow. Or if you're still weak as shit, you're still weak as shit. Like, or if you're still really unfit, people don't want to know this because people don't like to do cardio in, you know, just in their heads. If you're unfit, you should prioritize your fitness in the off season. Just because you're not playing a game doesn't mean that you don't need to be fit anymore. Like, actually, this is a great time to build some fitness. Where it differs, as you said, is how hard you can push that stimulus. So the fatigue isn't it still needs to be managed in order to progress. I like the way you phrase that, though, performance versus progress. So when you're trying to progress, you can dig a hole and know that, like, eventually when that all fatigue all dissipates, you're then going to come out the other side so much better for it. And whether that be, you know, through longer runs or harder conditioning sessions or through more volume of weights, whatever the case may be, you're still working the full spectrum or the areas of the spectrum that you need to emphasize as well. But you're just emphasizing that much more, and you're able to do much, like, a little bit more, because you haven't got that lingering Saturday game, potential Tuesday, where you have to still perform at your best because, you know, you're still vying for your positions. It is a lot more about, okay, what are we working towards? We can have a lot more of a singular focus. You can have a couple of different focuses, but you can not have to worry about the rugby on the weekend as an athlete.
No, and I think the way that I look at it is, whenever it comes to development stuff, you've got your pie, right? And you know, the circle of the pie is set to the amount of volume that you can actually recover from. And in season, a big chunk of that is taken up by Tuesday, Thursday training, game on a Saturday. I think coming into the off season, that pie is just so much bigger, and there's actually more training energy that you can allocate it. It's just that what divisions of that pie do you need to dedicate to strength, speed, power, and conditioning? Like, where do you lie? And that's where then that sets you up for what I find the most interesting part as a strength coach is, like, our job is doing strength coaching. It's like, right, how can we actually get you coming to a point now where preseason comes, you've ironed out all the weaknesses that you've had, and you get to show your coach that you have come back a better athlete? Because you're not a better rugby player at that point, because you probably haven't touched a ball for 6, 8, 10 weeks, but you are a much better athlete. And then you can take on your training at a better rate. You can progress. You can recover from more scrums. You can, you know, that game of touch where it's turn and burn, you can actually run back the other way. And those are the things then that really excite me as a strength coach is coming into this off season, because I believe it's the most vital time for rugby players if they do actually want to make some solid progress as an athlete.
The biggest difficulty I find with off season is that you don't get that validation. As you've got to wait like till preseason. So I remember the worst time I had with this was with COVID. So it's like we had to wait months and months and months to fucking get to a training session. You're like, oh, holy shit, I'm so much fitter. And like, and also comparing to people that have done nothing. And that's the other thing, like day one of preseason is a big eye opener for a lot of people, right? Because some people don't haven't had that gratification that in every training session, knowing that they're getting better. So they can see it on their stats. But still, is that really going to transfer? And then they see it transfer, and then you've got the people that have kind of dropped the ball in the off season. Whilst we're on that, we'll touch on stats real quick, because I know you're quite strong with this. So you have like goals as per body weight to hit. I've seen you implement those a lot on your Instagram, which means obviously you implement them with your training. Specific key lifts. Do you want to touch on those and why you think those are very really valuable?
Yeah, 100%. I think it bleeds on quite nicely, because the influences that I've had and the people that I've mentored from, their whole catchphrase is like, if you're not assessing, you're guessing. And I think a lot of the times people come into the off season, like you said, and it is that delayed gratification of you don't actually get to reap the rewards of the hard work that you put in until preseason comes. And more often than not, that's a deterrent for most people to actually fall off the ball, slack off things, mm-hmm. and not actually progress and carry on pushing. But that is exactly why we track so many different key avenues, because if you have clear hard cut data of targets that you need to work to based on, you know, some of the historical data out there from pro rugby players and people that have, you know, walked the walk that you want to go down, and then you have your data to back up exactly where you fall short, where your strengths, your weaknesses are, it just simply means then that, you know, you have these clear-cut targets and this framework to work from. So when it comes to strength work, we track 8 key lifts. We track the front squat, the back squat, and the deadlift as like the 3 main KPI lifts. But then we've also got kind of like the trap bar branching off that. We've got some RDL stuff as well, and some split squat and good mornings as like the full base of exercises. And then for the upper body, we've got a chin-up, a overhead press, an incline press, a bench press, and a strict dip. And those big 8 key lifts for us from like a lower body primary perspective indicate where our strengths are and where our weaknesses are. Because mm-hmm. most people may come in with very, very poor mobility. They can't get into the right positions, and their back squat way outweighs their front squat. And then it's a case of, well, you can look at why the difference is there, and then you can plug the weak links in the chain. It may be a case of a front row forward, they've been battered, their shoulders can't actually get into the right position, they're beaten up. And it's like, well, okay, that is a test lift. We've got the information then to go and build your program to work on, because we know that, you know, based on the ratios that are out there, this should be this compared to this lift. And it's the same for the upper body then. And I think the reason why we track these is it just gives people an objective metric to work to, and people love progress. If they know they're progressing, that's the thing that's going to keep them bought in for that off season, for that long preseason, or even better yet, that's going to be the thing that helps them keep like something in their program year round, which I think should be the goal for every single rugby player, is to be able to dominate a good off season, a good preseason, and a good in season, because there's not many elite athletes that slack off for any single one of those phases and still make a very, very great season.
Yeah. I think having those lifts as motivation is huge, especially when you can compare. Because again, yeah, when we were coming up, that day it wasn't anywhere. I think I saw Byron Kelleher once do, like, I think he had 3 plates, but this video is so fucking pixelated. You have no idea what's going on. It's not even like the... I feel like the All Blacks right now do like intentional dodgy camera work just so you can't see how deep their squats are and stuff. It's funny the way that they do it, but... England's social media seems to be pretty good. Wales is getting better, and Scotland's are pretty decent where they're just lifting good tin because they know that's going to get reactions, and then every genius in the comments criticizes why it's terrible. But you can see the lifts, and you can actually go, okay, this is what this person has done. And I actually think it's valuable on the opposite side of the spectrum as well, where, oh, okay, I'm already, like, front rows will love this because the front rows will be, oh, I'm more like, when they get shocked at how little, quote unquote, Ellis Genge lifts, and you're like, oh, I'm already as strong as Ellis Genge. Do you think you really need to spend all five of your sessions that you've got available on then continually growing strength? Or do you think something else is missing in your arsenal that could be further developed to help you play rugby? I think it helps on that end of the spectrum as well. I don't know whether you use it as much for that, but I think that can be one. And then the motivator, of course, again, all these little tools, as we've already said, we said it right at the start, right? We love to see ourselves progress. And if we've got the key lifts to help us actually eye our own progress and see that week to week, or even sometimes it has to take like month to month for you to see. And it's not in just, oh, I squatted this exact 1 RM more than the other 1 RM. More of the case ends up being like, oh, this was a little bit easier, or this felt so much smoother, or my total volume was significantly higher and I didn't realize it. And I think that's something I also try and lean on people is, or tell to people to lean on, is it's not just about your good days. Your good days are great, but there's also if you can still perform decent enough on your crap days, compare that to your crap days when you weren't doing this, and you'll see a huge difference. But the fact is, most people don't. They compare their crap days to 2 months ago's best day. Well, that's not how it works.
No, and that's the thing. They say, like, you want to try and compare apples to apples rather than apples to oranges. Like, whenever you kind of compare lifts, whenever you compare your best to your worst, you're not comparing apples to apples, because readiness can fluctuate 18% on any given day, which means that your 1 RM could be 18% higher, 18% lower, depending on kind of how the day's gone. And most people don't have the ability to optimize their structure for perfect recovery, for kind of that timed performance peak where, you know, kind of if you was going into a pro setup, on a Monday, you're going to do your heavy lower body lift, which means that on a Tuesday, you can kind of relax off a little bit. But when people are in work, like, we've got some guys that work 12-hour shifts that kind of, you know, manually handle things all day. Well, you're not going to be able to perform at your best if you've done that all day. Or it could be one of those freak days where you come in and it's just like, you know, we've had lads hit PBs off hangovers, and it's like, well, yeah, it was just a good day for you, mate.
I know so many people that have had a hangover and then they end up hitting it. It's fucking... I think it's just like the your inhibitions are just completely gone because you're like, fuck it. Oh, I don't know. Like, whereas if you've like taken a 2 week taper and you're perfectly trying to build yourself up for this lift, maybe you just overthink it.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, man.
That is 100%. Maybe we're preaching the wrong stuff. Maybe just get pissed every single day. Who knows? Maybe the amateurs have got it right. Yeah. They've got it spot on. But yeah, it's like you said, the more data that you can collect on stuff, and it's why I'm like big on tracking things for our athletes, is because most people slack off this stuff. I'm guilty of it myself. It's why I've got a coach. My coach looks after all my training for me because I'm rubbish at crossing the T's and dotting the I's. And if you can get someone that can help you kind of store that data, look through the data, read that data, and actually realize that you are progressing, you are doing the right things, you are pushing things on from the whole core four, like, that's where you'll start to get that buy into that program. And that's where you'll start to want to train harder because you are making progress. So the people that step on the weighing scale, they see the scale go up, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, fuck this. You know what? I'm just going to go bury my head in the Domino's pizza, feel sorry for myself. Nothing's working. Whereas if you step on that scale, you feel good because that number's come down. You're like, yeah, I'm motivated to work. I want to put in a little bit more. I'm already seeing that result. I think the more you can leverage that with your own training, because it is one of those tasks that emotions play a big role in how you perceive the training process. If you can kind of structure all the, well, fix the deck to win almost in that aspect, you're going to be a lot better off.
Yeah, data is, it's just the biggest thing, because it always is objective, right? So like, I think so many people, we like to get so many different pieces of data just so, because I think we like to find that win, right? You said you stand on a scale and you're like, yes, but you know, you could have just taken a giant shit and you're actually fatter than yesterday or whatever, you know, well, you're not going to be fatter in a day, but you get my point, right? You've done nothing better. And you still feel better. And that still ends up like giving you some level of motivation. Whereas you could have done everything right, just happened to retain a little bit more water with your nutrition and you're 2 kilos heavier. And you're just like, oh, what's the fucking point? You know, because we have such an emotional sort of reaction to that data. So we want to, rather than say, sack that off, what you want to do instead is, why don't you weigh, like, perfect example, if we just continue using the scale, if you just weigh yourself every day, it reaffirms that it's actually just data, right? So then that big 2 kilo jump actually gets taken away and you lose 3 kilos the next day because you then piss out all of that water, you feel good. All of a sudden you're like, oh, I haven't completely messed up because I've got data. Or you then have a bad reaction and that weight goes up and up and up and up. Still data, right? Same thing for your lifts. So it helps you. You're always going to continually find yourself trending in a certain direction. So it helps you then compare your apples to apples and know, and not base your decisions on emotion, but actually base them on what the physical body is producing. The flip side to that is, I'm always giving it a flip side, because is the Whoop, right? I just said it before, people love to use the Whoop, and then we love to track as many pieces of data through the Whoop. And now all of a sudden our Whoop is telling us that even though we're waking up and we're feeling good, right? We see our Whoop score is like, our score is 40. I don't know what that means, but you know, maybe that's a bad score on Whoop. All of a sudden we're like, crap, I'm tired. That means I'm not going to be able to push myself in the gym today. That means like this, this, and this, and this. And all of a sudden we start telling ourselves the story. And again, it's just another emotional reaction to data being given to us. So I think that's the biggest challenge. I think it's a difficult challenge for us as coaches to face, let alone if you're that person that's given that emotional reaction to that data. Like, again, I've already just gone through the examples of how we tend to judge our reactions very poorly because of the emotions. Whereas that's the beauty of a coach, is they're not having those emotions. They don't think you're a failure because you weigh 2 kilos heavier. They don't think you're weak as piss because your squat session didn't go as you'd think it planned. Us, on the other hand, even us as coaches, right? When we react to it, we're like, oh, crap. Like, what's the point of me even squatting? Maybe I shouldn't just bother squatting. Maybe I should do something else. Or maybe I should just do front squats or completely sack off squatting. Maybe my femurs are too long. Instead, I'm just going to do Zercher reverse lunges for a year instead. And maybe that will help my squat out somehow, you know?
It's so true. And I think it's that flip side of the whole, when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. I think a lot of people kind of, we set almost measures of physical strength. We set measures of power, speed, whatever it may be. And then people base their whole kind of outcome of success on that certain thing. And it's like, well, no, your goal is to be better at rugby. It's not to hit numbers. It may be, if your goal is to hit these numbers, then great, you know what, we'll kind of work towards those, and if you feel good doing it, fine. But it's always making sure that whatever decisions that you do make is the whole cliche of whatever makes the boat go faster. And I think that's that kind of whole non-emotional view to it as well, and that's why a coach is important, is they can pull you to the things that actually matter, rather than, you know, your Whoop score. We had a lad, like, I've told him to take his Whoop off on a Thursday night, because as soon as Friday comes, he's like, I can see my score dipping. Then on a Saturday, he wakes up and he's like, oh, my recovery score's down. And we tried so many different things. And it was a case of we tried moving, took his primer session away. We ended up, you know, moving his strength stuff very early in the week. We tried all these things, apart from just being like, does your fucking Whoop score matter that much? Just take it off.
Yeah, how do you actually feel?
And he was like, yeah, you know what? I do feel a little bit sluggish on these days, but since we've been doing this, I feel a lot better. So I think it was just a story that he was telling himself as well, because it's like the data was reaffirming that thing.
I had a lad, Sean, like, I literally last week, to sack off his whoop, shout out to Sean. He said, I've not renewed my membership anymore. I'm done with it. Because he, same thing, right? But the worst one with him was during preseason, he's like, oh, my recovery score's all the way down. I'm like, mate, you're in week one of preseason. You've just come from a holiday where you've traveled to New Zealand, right? As far away as you can travel. Of course your score's low, mate. That's the point, you know? And he's like, oh, yeah, you're right. And he's like, fuck, but I'm trying to do all this work and my score's low. I'm like, if you're doing all this work, you're not going to have a good whoop score. It's just how it is. And then, yeah, you wake up and it's that anxiety of telling yourself that you've had a bad sleep. And so, yeah, he ended up just sacking it off as well. And, yeah, you should still get a good night's sleep. But maybe instead of – and still somehow find a measure of tracking that. But maybe your measure, instead of having this whoop score that algorithmically – is actually shown in the science not to be the best, maybe you just say, okay, how many hours can I be in bed? Because I've been saying this for a long time, is because of a book, not the Matthew Walker one. It was like the OG. I can't remember. I think it was just called Sleep. I've had the guy on the podcast. I forget his name, but most people's biggest problem is just, it's not the perfect bedtime setup or the perfect, like, getting your perfect temperature or whatever it is. It's actually just being in bed long enough and then winding down before bed. Most people don't do that. So why don't you just track, okay, how many hours am I in bed? And if you get that to enough, you'll probably find that, like, tell me if I'm wrong, call me out if I'm wrong. But most, 99% of people are going to find that all of a sudden their sleep is fine and they recover much better.
100%, but I think it's that social media landscape yet again that feeds the, you know, the perfect morning routine, the perfect bedtime routine, wanking off in an ice bath, having this perfect recovery thing. And it's like,
yeah.
But the whole problem is, if you're training hard, you're pushing yourself, you're purposely overreaching and doing a little bit more than your body's capable of recovering from, in a short time frame, your recovery score is going to go down. Like, just accept
you want that. That's a good thing. It means you're going to get better.
That's the byproduct of actually having a good S&C program, is having days where your recovery is going to dip. Like today, on a Monday, Tuesday, I do back-to-back conditioning strength work as well. So I've had four sessions in 2 days. I know for a fact today, my recovery score would be down if I actually cared for that. My body weight is up because of inflammation, things like that, of just pushing myself. But I know towards the tail end of the week, my body weight's going to start to drop. I'm going to feel better. And naturally, I'm going to be able to have another hard session probably on Friday, which is the way that I've structured my training. So, yeah, it's the problem with the silver bullet yet again. People are like, well, what's the missing piece of my recovery?
Okay, so now I'm going to ask people, if they want to find the silver bullet, the missing piece, the secret sauce, the solution to all their problems, they want to find it by following you on social media, I think, because I think you present it on the daily, right? So how can they go about following you on Instagram? Is it only Instagram you use now?
Yeah, it is only Instagram. I'm trying to build into getting more of a YouTube presence as well. That's my next adventure. So I'll probably try and pick your brains on that, because I know you've been there, done that, and currently wearing the T-shirt.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you want to find me on Instagram, it's joelharries.strengthsolution. And that is pretty much the only place you'll find me. You may see a TikTok under that as well. But for the time being, that's literally the main hub of where you'll find this man, hopefully dropping knowledge bombs daily.
Yeah, I'll obviously put it in the show notes. When you get your YouTube up and running, I'll put it in the show notes. If you already got it, like the channel started, and you're just going to start to put it on?
No, not yet. I'm in the pre-contemplation phase where I'm just like, you know what, I want to try and make this work. So I'll definitely drop you a message to see how you get things started.
Do it, mate. I've enjoyed chatting anyway, so I think you're good. You'll be fine for it. I think you've clearly got enough knowledge, well thought out with this stuff. It's not just like book knowledge. It's clearly like practicality knowledge as well, which only comes from doing the thing. So I've really enjoyed having you on, mate. I've enjoyed having this chat. I'm sure I'll get you back on again. We'll have another chat in the future. Listeners, go ahead and go follow him on Instagram. Your videos are really good as well, man. I enjoy them, but it's not just the spammy stuff. In fact, it's never spammy stuff. I don't think I've ever seen a post of yours where I've gone, nah, that's wrong. So far. There will be a day, and I'll call you out, mate.
I look forward to that day. But no, I appreciate you having me on, Tom. Anyway, thank you very much, mate.
No, thanks for coming on.